of the Joint Ways and Means Committee for Thursday, February 17th, 2005. We are opening without a quorum, and we hope that that will change soon. Want to welcome forward again Kingsley Click, our State Court Administrator, to outline what we will be discussing today, and please go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator. And today we were going to pick up where we were the day before yesterday, in the middle of Nancy Miller going through the major initiatives. So we thought we'd just pick up from there. And I think after the discussion yesterday on the performance measures, a lot of the projects will have better context. So that works out. And then we'll just go briefly over the other two major program areas of our budget that we hadn't covered the previous days, which was our mandated payments and our administration. And then we'll go into kind of a walkthrough of our overall budget priorities and reduction options. And during that time, of course, any questions that the committee has, we'll be happy to do. So, Nancy, if I have you.
Thank you. And as Nancy Miller is coming forward, Nancy, if you would also talk to us about the responses you provided to questions yesterday about the interpreter services.
Can do, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Miller.
Thank you. And for the record again, Nancy Miller, excuse me, Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations. I provided the committee with a memo in response to the chair's question. We can actually go back to page 27 in the notebook, because that takes us back to court interpreter services, and I was only one page beyond that when I left off the other day. The chair's question was how we are doing in terms of the availability of certified interpreters and what our challenges are. And what you can see with this memo is that we have 74 certified interpreters available to us. Our interpreter services program manager, James Comstock, is here today and can explain any of this in any further depth after I'm done if you need it. We have 11 Spanish staff interpreter positions, and as I talked about the other day, two American Sign Language interpreters. And the memo shows you where the staff positions are: Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Marion, Lynn, which also covers Benton, Jackson, Umatilla, which also covers Morrow, and Deschutes, which covers Crook and Jefferson as well. The two sign language interpreters are housed here in Salem, and they cover matters around the state. We are at the point that all of our courts have the ability to access the Spanish interpreters. The interesting dynamic now is that the demand from the outlying areas has pulled some of our staff interpreters away from the metro courts, bigger courts, out to the outlying areas. When we talk to you about our budget packages, you'll see that we have a package in for additional staff interpreters, so we'll be talking about that some more. The American Sign Language interpreter issue is a difficult one, and as you can see by the memo, really it's the market change that drives that. The rates that are paid for American Sign Language interpreters out in the private sector are more than we pay. This is a very specialized group of people. So with our two staff interpreters, what we're going to do is try to expand our ability to do video interpreting. You have to have pretty good size bandwidth to do that, because you don't want to do video interpreting with sign language reporters and have the movements be herky-jerky. That's obviously a major problem when you're doing sign interpreting. In terms of the other languages, we're doing pretty well with Russian interpreters and feel like we have an appropriate number to meet our needs. As we talked about very briefly the day before yesterday, some of the indigenous languages provide a major challenge for us. We are now working very hard at finding more efficient ways to use the interpreter pool. We have four schedulers on staff now that really do a good job, I think, in kind of dispensing our interpreter pool to make sure that we've got coverage where we need it and we're not duplicating efforts with the local courts. So we're pretty excited about how things are going, but I do want to leave you with the thought that that policy package is an important one for us. Those are the interpreter issues.
And Representative Hansen, as I recall, on yesterday you had a question about American Sign Language interpreters, and I would just point out that on the reverse side of the there's some additional information for you.
And Madam Chair, yesterday you also asked about whether we are still a leader in the access to justice arena.
Yes.
And Leola McKenzie, with whom you are familiar, who is our assistant division director, provided a quick email to me, and I'm sorry it's not more formal. I will give you the quick email that she provided. And the bottom line here is that Leola believes we are still a leader as a state. We have challenges that we need to overcome. In our workforce diversity, you heard us talk yesterday in the performance measure discussion about the new diversity outreach committee that the personnel division has put together. Leola's opinion, and Leola is someone who has served on the access committee for a very long time and is very well aware of the issues that face us. This is probably our biggest challenge in our workforce diversity. So it's something that we built the performance measure around so that we would make sure to put the focus and effort where it is most needed. And as you can see here, we were one of the founding members of the Consortium of State Court Interpreter Services. We are definitely a leader in our interpreter program, and the task forces that we have done are still national models, and the work that we're doing in the Americans with Disabilities Act area now are also seen as national models. And you can see, as Leola says on the bottom, even though it's not ours, and I talked about this yesterday, the Governor's Task Force on Overrepresentation in the Juvenile Justice System, it is a model for the nation, and we are key participants in that effort.
I would also just take note of the last sentence. If I may just read this into the record, to paraphrase, other states are really amazed with the governor's task force on overrepresentation in the juvenile justice system, that the governor and chief justice are there with 300 plus others from around the state to focus on the on this issue is definitely way beyond what other states are doing. Again, I just think it's so important that we keep in front of us not only what we are doing, but that we do carry a leadership role within these United States. And in times, in these times when we are bemoaning our fiscal situation, and other declines, it's important to celebrate the things that we're doing right and doing well, and to always look for opportunities to build on what we are doing right and what we are doing well. And then, as always, as I know the chief would say, be very forthright about what continue to be our challenges. So I appreciate that the information is here in this form, and we'll make sure that it gets shared. Representative Wisnot.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Miller, I guess you're the one to ask about this. I found this chart that you provided informative about the Oregon Treatment and Problem Solving Course. Could you tell us, you know, how we create these, what prioritize, because, like, I look at my county, we only have two, and and I'm really concerned because I didn't know about these, and I'm on the Commission for Children and Families. I should have known about them. But, you know, how do you prioritize them? How do you fund them? Is it local county? I think also, it's probably not from Salem, but in our county we have the teen courts, and the teen courts are really, I've participated in those, and they're excellent ways to help the courts, and I think also help our some of our young juveniles not get in the system and still correct them, their behavior. So could you address, you know, how are they funded, how are they prioritized, why do some counties have everything and some don't?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, excellent question. We developed some years ago a six-year strategy for the development of family courts and drug courts. Deschutes County and Jackson County were the leaders in the development of their family court. We had folks coming from the National Center for State Courts and other places to look at what was going on in Deschutes and Jackson. Several of these courts started out with grants, and they are kind of a multi-step process depending on the court. And just because you asked the question, I'll skip over. If you look at page 31, that page talks about the family courts. I used to draw a picture for folks about our vision of an integrated treatment court as kind of the end of the highway, the cathedral at the end of the highway, if you will. And each court took a road to that cathedral in a different manner. Some courts started with the development of family courts. Some courts started with the development of drug courts. Some courts started with mental health courts or domestic violence courts. And they built onto that as they moved toward that cathedral at the end. The family court process was built really in three phases, if you will. We started with the hiring of family court clerks in the courts that were interested in developing family courts. That was the beginning of the one judge, one family model. What those clerks did was bundle the cases together. In the old days, in the courts that didn't have family courts, you could very easily have cases pending before five judges. If you will, you could have a criminal case, you could have a divorce, you could have a restraining order, you could have some other kind of civil case, a child abuse case, and those would all be in front of different judges. What the family court clerks did was bundle all those cases and make sure that they were in front of one judge. Deschutes County did a study at the beginning, probably I think 2 years into the development of its family court. I may be a little wrong on the years, and Ernie Maserol can provide that for you. It was amazingly interesting. It talked about how 20% of the families were using 80% of the court's resources, because those are the families that you saw with the multiple cases and you saw over and over again. The next step in the development of the family courts was the development of the facilitation programs that we talked about yesterday, hiring specialized court staff to provide services to people who were appearing unrepresented. And then the third phase was the hiring of the family court coordinators. And a family court coordinator, that's when you get to that point, you've got a pretty well, fully functioning family court. What that person's job is to bring all the players to the table to make sure that there is one integrated case plan for those families. Because just the same way you might have the case in front of five judges, you might have the case being touched by three or four different agencies. So you've got a plan by adult probation, a plan by juvenile probation, a plan by DHS, and one of the things, and then court orders for each. And one of the things that we found often in citizen review board reviews is that the adult probation officer might be telling the family to do one thing, and DHS might be telling the family to do something different. So you're kind of running around from resource to resource. The family court coordinator brings all those people to the table and says, let's get one plan that resolves all those cases. So that's just a brief explanation of how the courts work. To your question, a lot of these started out with grant money. Some of them, through our six-year plan, have been funded by the legislature. We lost some during the 03-05 cuts that were made to the Judicial Department, and you will see, again, in our policy packages, we are standing the possibility of losing several of our drug court coordinators because the funding is drying up from the federal level for ongoing drug court support. So you will see a policy package that continues those drug court coordinators with general fund. But it was really court by court and pot by pot, if you will.
If I might add, Nancy, Representative, a lot of the reason it started in the different ways was it depended on the community partners, and a lot of the courts had different willingness or resources locally in certain areas, and that's part of the reason they started off at different points, but as Nancy said, going to the same goal in the end.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Looks like we should have been doing this long enough, we should have some performance outcomes. It should be easy to put performance outcomes on these, and like you just said, at 20% of the families creating 80% of the court workload, some of that stuff, reducing court time, you know, that 50% of them don't get into crime or something like that after this. It looks like we could be easy to measure that and put that as a priority in our when we start considering cuts for this.
And Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, this does relate, and Kingsley's right, it's much easier to talk about this after having talked about the performance measures because there's a context that you now have. Our drug court performance measure does, as we talked about yesterday, measure recidivism. I was watching when Director Williams was telling you that the recidivism rate out of the Department of Corrections, I believe he said, was 30%. So we were measuring initially felony and misdemeanor reoffenses within 1 year, and we were at 15, I think it was. So I asked my staff if they would do a quick run to match what corrections is looking at, and these numbers are preliminary and we need to work on them some more, but what our analysts found is if we do the same measure that Director Williams is doing, 3 years felony, we were at 12.6, he was at 30, probation I believe is at 23, so if you're just doing straight probation. So drug court works, and there is data nationally about the effectiveness of drug court. Family courts, there isn't quite as much available data, but we do have the measure about the family court facilitation services, and I think the measure about creating the juvenile court plans for more positive outcomes for children in foster care, it would be interesting to compare those outcomes as we move along in courts that have family courts and courts that don't. So that would be an interesting concept.
Last little follow-on.
Certainly.
I just I think the family, because my experience in Deschutes County is that you can't just look, and the judges can't look at the person in front of them because it is all interrelated with the family. The mother's on drugs, or the mother's, you know, the problem, and the kids, you can't expect the kid to survive in that environment. So it looks like it's a necessity to bring all the players of the family if you've got all of them involved in items that are for the judiciary.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, hold that thought.
And family courts have been around for how long?
I want to, Mr. Adams knows because he was one of the first.
And please swing that microphone around. Good afternoon.
Madam Chair, hi. Good afternoon. Jim Adams, Trial Court Administrator, Jackson County. Deschutes County was the first integrated family court in the nation, and I believe they've been around about 6 years. Jackson County was the second, and we've been around about four. And Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, I can share with you that Oregon facilitated the first dialogue on the creation of performance measures for family courts about 2.5 years ago, I believe. As we speak, Deschutes County and Jackson County and at least two other counties are participating in a national grant to measure the effectiveness of family courts. And these studies actually will include a blind study component. And as far as I know, that's the first time that's ever been done. It's being done by the leading research institute in the nation out of Boulder, Colorado. There is also an adjunct study that builds upon what's affectionately referred to as the Shady Cove study on family court performance measures, and that's being facilitated through Southern Oregon University.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
A couple quick things while we're on this subject. One of the features that I like best about the family courts and even the drug court, the bundling. Because if somebody's actually ever tried to turn their life around, if they've got pending charges in two different counties or in three different courtrooms and they get one matter squared away and then they do 30 days on another matter, and I mean it's just hard for them to ever get grounded and get their life turned around. But if it can all come together, then there's a real opportunity. Other one, and I just have to share this. I went to a drug court graduation exercise, and if you ever get a chance to go to one of them, they're wonderful. But there was one young woman, I guess she was in her mid to late 20s, and it looked like she lived a pretty hard life. She was graduating. Her two daughters were there in really party dresses.
Mm-hmm.
Her mom and dad were there. It's the first time she'd graduated from anything in her life, and that family was just so proud, and her daughters were so proud of her and her parents and stuff. It was just a pretty wonderful moment. And I don't know what happened to her, but my sense would be if she was incredibly likely to succeed with the type of support that would be generated. And they're just good programs. We started funding ours in Multnomah County. It was a judicial grant that got the seed money to get it started. And then, obviously, drug treatment that was paid through the Oregon Health Plan. And then we still needed some cash, and we got money from the city of Portland based on the decrease that they'd be spending on police overtime. Because you could virtually run the court off of what the city of Portland was saving on overtime of having cops waiting around to testify at drug trials. So it's pretty exciting programs.
I would add, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for providing that background. I'm reminded that the late Judge Roosevelt Robinson, and I'm just honored to call his name at this particular time, who was a leading advocate for drug courts, invited me to one of those graduation ceremonies that you speak of. And you're right, it was a very powerful and very moving experience just to get a glimpse of and understand what some people had gone through to get to that particular moment. So again, thank you for bringing that forward.
Thank you, Jim. And talking about police overtime is a good segue to page 28. I just want to give you a brief explanation of some of the major criminal law support initiatives that we have going on right now. The Chief Justice has appointed a Criminal Justice Advisory Committee. The Chief has had that committee for some time, and again, during our budget reductions, we had to stop most of the work on these initiatives that we were working on. So the Chief reappointed the committee, and it is a group that really focuses on statewide system issues in the criminal justice system. There are prosecutors on it, defense attorneys, the state bar is represented, an excellent group of people. And we're focusing right now on three main areas. Probably the biggest one is the second one on your handout. It's called the Case Management Work Group. That was referred to us by the governor's...
31.
I'm sorry, 28. Did I say 50? 28. it was referred. That issue was referred to us by the governor's task force. It is something that we were planning to work on anyway because it's obviously a big issue for us. We are looking at best practices for calendaring systems. There was a lot of concern expressed at the governor's task force about the fact that police were spending a lot of time waiting for court hearings, that we have our own concerns that if cases are settled at the last minute, we've called in interpreters, we've called in juries, we've spent money, we've inconvenienced the public. And at the very last second, we're saying, oh, never mind, the case is settled. And it's not that that's a bad thing, but it's a good thing, but how we use those resources and calendar those cases is what this work group is going to be looking at to see if there are ways that we can adopt best practices to make sure that we're not investing those resources and then having things go away at the last minute. The technology work group is looking at the implementation of the Uniform Criminal Judgment. This is something that the Department of Corrections and the Attorney General's Office are very interested in. Director Williams told me that he would be willing, if he's watching, he'll laugh, but he told me he would be willing to skip down the halls of the legislature and tell people how important it was for us to implement the Uniform Criminal Judgment.
Talking money or just skipping?
I said, skip and collect money on your way, Max.
Actually, to see that, we could probably sell tickets for the food bank.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, good idea. And then the Uniform Script Work Group is working on developing, as you can see, there a model statement for judges to use in presenting information to defendants seeking to waive counsel and or enter a guilty plea. We just want to have some consistency across the state about how that works. So those are the three main work groups. You can also see there we have a Judicial Conference Criminal Law Committee made up of judges who look at procedural issues, and they are very active in helping us address policy issues that arise, that come to our attention from our partners. So those are our major initiatives in the criminal law arena.
Just to do a time check at this point, we're going to need at least an hour to talk about the priorities and reduction options, which is the last item on our agenda. So that will give you some idea of how to budget your remarks.
And we can, if anybody doesn't have further questions, we can skip over the drug and treatment courts.
Representative Hansen.
Hopefully a quick question. Maybe you can fill me in on it later. What's the relationship between Chief Justice, the Criminal Justice Advisory Committees, and is it the Judicial Planning, Justice Planning Commission? The one that works on procedures that we cut down to almost nothing?
Council on Court Procedures.
Oh, the Council on Court Procedures.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen and Kingsley may have a better, more comprehensive answer. They focus on civil law and this criminal. She's nodding. That's always good.
And let the record also show that we now have a quorum. Please go forward.
Thank you. So the Drug and Treatment Court Support Services, we talked about, just a quick mention, our drug court management system was funded by a federal grant. It is a comprehensive system that collects data from both the courts and the treatment providers. We're pretty excited about that. Education and Training Program Services on the next page. My division is responsible for all judicial education and employee education. And just to give you a context, I won't go through this with all of the pieces of my division. You'll see it later. But when I say that we're responsible for all the judicial education and all the employee education, that's one lawyer and two support staff. So we're not talking about a big team here. And you can just see there the kinds of training that we provide to the judges and to the staff. The family court piece we did on page 32. Jury program support we talked about a bit yesterday, so I won't go over that. We have a performance measure related to juror satisfaction, and the juror access and improvement account is one of the major initiatives that we're working on. On page 33, the Juvenile Court Improvement Project I talked about a little bit 2 days ago, federal grant. to improve our practices in juvenile court. And I just want to say about that, I've been with the Judicial Department for 17 years now, and I may have said this the other day, but it is my favorite story. When I first came to the department, juvenile court was not the place to be. I used to tell a joke that it was where you went until you learned how to put your robe on frontwards, and then you went downtown and did real law. Juvenile court now, with the leadership of the Chief Justice, is where we're seeing judges feel like they really make a difference. Judge Abernathy has been on the bench for some time. Mm-hmm. She requested the transfer to juvenile court. She requested to be the juvenile court judge. And the kind of commitment and passion that we see from those judges supported by this project is amazing. And this project brings in, is funded with $185,000 a year in federal money. So we're not talking about big money, and the bang that it gets for the buck is phenomenal. Our program planning and evaluation services, I think you saw in action yesterday. That team, which is made up of an executive analyst and two court programs analysts that are also assigned to other duties, is responsible for the Judicial Department's strategic planning effort, all of our performance measures work, and they do evaluations of programs that we have in the department. And that is the very quick walkthrough of our major initiatives. Please continue.
Have you set up just for mandated payments? Please ask questions.
Very briefly, pages 44 and 45 just highlight the mandated payments appropriation in our account. It's approximately 4% of the general funded budget, and it's pretty straightforward. It's the payments for the jurors, it's the payments for the interpreters, it's the payments for ADA accommodation, and then there's some miscellaneous things by statute that provide for us to pay. Juror costs are about 63% of it. Interpreters are about 36%. Arbitration and ADA are about 0.5% of those overall costs. And they don't really exist separately. They all exist in coordination with the case types being processed by the court. So when we get into the reduction planning and things like that, there's kind of corresponding dollars attached on the approximate breakout of the caseloads. So they are there for our what I call the ancillary payments that go with processing a case through the system. We've already talked about a lot about the court interpreters, but we did just, I thought it was interesting to see that we're actively dealing over the last several years with a total of 82 languages and dialects and it just gives you a scope about that. Then moving on into administration and central support, I think since Nancy's up here and to kind of catch us up a little bit on time, on page 4 of your phase 1 materials, what we went in the overview was the org chart of the State Court Administrator's Office. And we have more written summary detail on the pages 20 to 24. But I think...
Was that page 4?
Page 4.
Thank you.
And it looked like this. Mm-hmm. It looked like a suspension bridge, which is pretty illustrative of the system because it supports the court system. I thought while Nancy was up here, if there was anything that you wanted to touch on that we haven't covered in the last few days by discussion of what all of your units are responsible for.
Madam Chair, members, I think the only thing we didn't talk about in my division is the ever-popular application and contribution program. That is a program that we manage out of my division. The courts determine whether an indigent person has the ability to pay part of the costs of court-appointed counsel. And there's a $20 application fee if the person can afford to pay it. And then the court can order that the person pay part of the cost of counsel. I have a statewide coordinator in my office who assists the trial courts in responding to a budget note that we had last session to implement that program statewide, and we have been regularly reporting to the legislature, and Ms. Lamont has been extremely helpful, in our implementation of that program. And other than that, I think we talked about everything in my division.
And the majority of your resources are in the CRB program, I think about half that number.
The CRB and the interpreter program.
I would just also note, Ms. Miller, that you have the judge staff education component under your jurisdiction, and I want to thank you again and also in advance for work that I know will be going forward around educating judges to circumstances and issues around parental abduction. I know you've been following the work of the task force appointed by the Senate president. And again, I just want to thank you for all that you've already done and all that I know you will do to help us get the information to judges.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will. Our education team is very committed to that.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification in your organizational chart, just trying to understand, are your human resources functions, whether those are personnel, payroll, are those all handled at the central level and there would be no corresponding group of people at the individual court level that would be full-time involved in those activities? Obviously, somebody's probably collecting hours and stuff for reports, but...
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that's correct. We have approximately one human resource manager, plus almost 160 persons in the department.
Right.
So, but we do all the personnel plan, all the personnel work that goes in. Locally, courts have authority to hire and work with our personnel department on the paperwork and certainly the timekeeping.
But has there been an effort, Madam Chair?
Sir?
Has there been an effort to basically eliminate duplication in that, in the sense of maintaining as minimal a level as you can at the local level, trying to get most of those functions centralized?
Senator Gourley, Senator Devlin, yes. I'm not aware of any duplication of effort. The only thing that could make us more effective in that area, of course, would be the technological support, and I know that the exec branch has been trying to work on some electronic systems for timekeeping and things that we would then be able to use, but that's, if there's any duplication, it's just in the manual sending up of papers.
Okay. Thank you.
I was going to bring up Susan Klosterman to talk just briefly about some of our financial initiatives in the context of what the office is responsible for. But since you've touched on what I call our infrastructure, if you have to have, you know, what's on the island, what do you need? You need your personnel system for the judicial department. You need your financial systems. You need your information and technology systems. And then we have our legal counsel division, which does all the judicial department contracts, risk management work in coordination with the Attorney General's office. So I would note Scott Crampton, our appellate court services division, that is we're the appellate records office for the Supreme Court and for the Court of Appeals. And also within those functions are the publications of the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals decisions, the State Law Library, which is used by both public, heavily by the Attorney General's office, and, of course, our people. The State Court Service Center, which is our archival and warehouse, and our building services. The only building we own is the Supreme Court, and we're responsible for the maintenance and upkeep of that building. And then that division also provides our telecommunications support, as well as works with the local trial courts on facilities issues to the extent that
as necessary. And then our exec services division, which is directly under me, and these other divisions really coordinate with business and programs, because everything that usually you're touching is a needs a team approach for expertise. We're kind of equivalent to what you'd see in the office of the governor, the office of the chief justice, where his central coordination, communications, public records, pro tem support, analysis is done and coordinates the overall the OSCA strategic plan. We did have 12 divisions of just about 3 years ago, and as when you know, with the budget cuts, there was serious reorganization and restructuring throughout the department. Whenever there's things like that that happen, there's negative consequences, but there's also an opportunity to recreate a better structure, and it let us have an opportunity to look at all we had been adding on to support courts and say we could do a better job if we consolidated those functions. And that's when I created the reduction from the 12 to the units that are here. Susan Klosterman with our business operations responsible for the kind of across the board business operations in addition to financial and internal auditing, and Nancy to coordinate all the program services with the courts and the initiatives, which gives us a chance to leverage. You can, you know, one analyst might be doing part education, part this, part that, the same with our other systems. So we not only reduced by about 3% our overall resources, we also, as was touched on yesterday, when there was an opportunity to restore positions to the trial courts and work on the parity, we took four of the positions and distributed them out to the courts as well to try to just improve the overall balance of the department. So, and we have, when we'll get into phase two, a lot of our positions are also other funded, either through part of the grant system or other revenue streams, as well as parts that are general funded. None of the services that we provide for the courts are on a charge basis. So unlike maybe some other systems where there's an assessment or fees to use the attorney or get information, we don't. We just provide what's needed centrally, and that seems to work out well for the courts as well as for us.
Did you want to bring up Ms. Klosterman?
Yes, I'm going to bring up Susan Klosterman just to briefly address a couple of the budget note initiatives where our financial systems are being redone, and then in response also to Senator Devlin's interest, even though in phase two we're going to talk more about the technology planning, I thought it would be appropriate just to highlight a few of the things that our IT technology systems support and do, and have an opportunity to address any questions you would have. But first, this is Susan Klosterman.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Klosterman. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Business Operations. And I, in the interest of time, I'll just make a few broad statements. I won't go into a lot of detail, but we do provide services to all 36 courts and the appellate courts and the divisions within the Office of the State Court Administrator, and all of those entities are centralized and use the same accounting systems, and we use almost exclusively the statewide administrative systems maintained by DAS. For example, the personnel division does use a statewide payroll system for paying all of the employees and the judges. And we do use a state financial management system for the payment of our vendor payments and our juror payments and the recording of all of the court revenues, and also for our financial reporting as part of the state's comprehensive annual financial report, and also for our management reports. We also use the contracts, price agreements for purchasing put in place by the Department of Administrative Services so as not to duplicate efforts. We also use the contracts put in place by the Department of Administrative Services to contract for private collection company services. We work with the Department of Revenue. They're one of our primary, in addition to the private collection firms, collection partners. They have almost 25 staff dedicated to court collections. And there were quite a few comments yesterday on the performance measure related to the collection rate. And I talked a little bit with Ms. Lamont this morning about that and would offer that in phase two if there's time, or if any of you individually would like to hear more about our collections program, we would be very glad to share that information with you. We provide services to the courts, and we also have responsibility to make sure that there are internal controls in place to safeguard the state's, the department's assets. And, of course, that's not something that we can do alone. We share that responsibility with trial court administrators, the presiding judges, and the others in the court system. So we work very closely with the courts to ensure that the policies and procedures that we put in place, as well as the systems, are as cost-effective as they can be, and also put some segregation of duties and other internal controls in place to help protect the assets. That may be more than you wanted to know even in that as far as business services, but I should mention also that we have an internal auditing program. It's comprised of three certified professional auditors. We are in the process of rebuilding that function in its glory days. It was one of the audit functions programs that was mentioned in the Secretary of State audit in 2002 as meeting all of their recommended requirements for an audit shop. We were down to one in our budget reduction times and hired two back last year and have a current audit plan, are in the process of putting some communications and structure to that process again, and we'll plan to establish an audit committee early in the next biennium. With that, are there any questions? I know that's very short.
I note under the internal auditing program that there is an advertised anonymous hotline. Does that hotline get any use, or what's been the experience?
Madam Chair, I don't think that there are always questions, you know, more hypothetical situations, or should I be doing this, but there haven't really, that I'm aware of, been any reported cases of fraud or abuse since I've been with the department, which has been almost 5 years.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Carl Ward is our Chief Information Officer for the Judicial Department, and he will briefly go over the IT shop supports our network of computer systems statewide once Tim were unified statewide system in that regard.
The last name. Ward?
Chair Gordley, members of the committee, my name is Carl Ward. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Judicial Department. My purpose here today is really twofold. I want to spend just a minute and give you some background, size, and shape of technology in the Judicial Department, and also then talk briefly about the new strategic plan that we've been developing over the past year, because it does set a new strategic direction for technology in the Judicial Department, and my goal is to hit that in about 10 minutes or less. I think I can do it.
I need to do less in order to
less.
Less?
I can do it.
Eight
timelines. Okay. This is hard on us, Madam Chair. We're as passionate about administration.
I know.
You're doing quite well, and there is phase two.
And I'll be glad to come back and do more of this in phase two if you guys are interested. The history of technology in the state court system really starts with state funding in 1983 and the development of OJIN in 1985, Oregon Judicial Information Network. That's our major application. It's been under basically continuous development since 1985. It's both the case management and financial system, has a lot of functionality. The courts run much of their day-to-day sort of back office business on that system. We developed a technology plan in 1999, dated March 2000. The major strategy was to
continue to make that system live into the future, redevelop it, enhance it, make it a modern system, that we did not envision the economic collapse that was soon to follow. We did receive funding in the 99 legislative session to do that. We funded and staffed up. We lost some of that staff over the years. Our interim strategy, as much in line with Senator Devlin's comments of hanging on with your fingernails, our interim strategy has just been to keep everything working and just hang on and sort of wait for better times. Last February, the chief appointed a task force, a special task force on the future of technology in the Judicial Department, comprised of 30 members, about half judges, half trial court administrators and division directors. There were some other interested stakeholders, a member of the bar, Robin Lamont, was on there. A couple of other interested stakeholders were involved in that strategic planning process. Our customers, and when I say our customers, I mean the people who really access OGIN and look at that case management system, are, of course, virtually everyone in the Judicial Department, but there are about 185 other government agencies, state, local, and city, who mostly criminal justice agencies, but some human resource agencies who actually access our system by way of the web, go in and look up information on cases for one reason or another. Additionally, we make that access, public access, available by way of the internet to the private, public, and business community on a subscription basis, and there are about 850 Oregon, mostly Oregon, businesses who access that system, representing about 1,200 users who access that system on a daily basis. Our technology environment and application systems are mostly in-house system developed, mostly fairly large, complex legacy system. A part of our new strategy is a change in direction for that. In addition to the case management and financial systems, notably, we've run a statewide jury management system. Most of these systems are uniform on a statewide basis. All the courts use them. All the courts use them in about the same way. So we've got pretty good statewide access and statewide uniformity. Those systems over the last 20 years represented an investment of tens of millions of dollars for the state and the Judicial Department. In the last year, as Susan and Kingsley mentioned, we had a couple of budget notes. We worked on a fairly comprehensive set of upgrades to our financial systems. We had a person-based system budget note. We made some enhancements to the system to make it easier to access case information on a by-person basis, or by driver's license number or various other person-centric IDs. We worked on a fairly large criminal history improvement program that was federally NCHIP funded in conjunction with state police. NCHIP is a national criminal history improvement program. We anticipate another NCHIP-funded a significant NCHIP-funded integration program to implement some of the system improvements that we identified in the previous NCHIP program in the next biennium, and are working with state police to get that off the ground even as we speak. We worked with Nancy Miller's shop to do some integration for juvenile calendaring between Services for Children and Family and the juvenile OGIN system in OGIN. My technology division is about 54 people, and we support all of the trial courts with that staff. On to strategic planning.
Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Mr. Ward, what's your FTEs been over? Has it gone down from 60 to 54? Were you up to, you know, is it growing? Is it, how's that, your FTEs been as far as in the last few years, please?
Chair Gordley and Representative Wisnett, I apologize if I've got your name wrong.
That's
is
good.
That right?
That's good.
We started staffing up with some new funding in 1999, and we peaked at 65 people in December of, was it 2001 or 2002? We peaked one of those Decembers, and within months after we peaked, I started losing people and not being able to refill those positions. So we've lost about 12 people. Most of those people end up in the long run having to come out of your development effort because that's the thing we can stop doing. So
Thank you.
Partially responsible for the change in strategy. As I mentioned, the Chief Justice appointed a special task force to develop a new strategic direction for the Judicial Department with respect to the technology for the next 10 years. The major drivers, and I've alluded to some of these, for taking on strategic planning at this point in time, because usually you take on strategic planning when you've got money to spend. So we're a little out of cycle, but we're anticipating better times. The plan we had was 5 years old. It hadn't been changed since the budget situation changed. It didn't anticipate the 90s economy crashing virtually the next year. We needed to revisit our central strategy of leveraging our existing investments in IT translation. We needed to revisit our strategy of in-house development of our applications. We needed to be able to move more quickly to integrate with our business partners and a few other business drivers as well. Those were really the sort of movers. Where we are today is that we are essentially finished with this process. We have a meeting tomorrow where we hope to nail down our tactical projects that we plan to take on in the next biennium. So I'm about to tell you what the strategy is. It's very short, and what I think the tactical projects will be. I'm a little bit out ahead of our task force, so this is about what it's going to be. It may change a little bit. We really have come up with three central strategies. One is we're revamping our governance structure to make it more inclusive and streamline it, virtually no cost to the taxpayers, just an internal management change. We are developing a new business model that we're going to call something like the e-court business model. We plan to aggressively migrate to the electronic court and paperless environment and delivery of services by way of the web and integration with our business partners. That's our immediate and central strategy. Our final strategy is, in the long term, we need to replace our existing case management system with a new case management system, either vendor supplied or from a peer state or group of peer states. That's the strategy. That's our 10-year plan. For tactical projects, what are we going to do in the next couple of years? We're looking at where we may have opportunity, where we may have projects that can be self-funded, where we may be able to take advantage of grant funding. And there are about four or five of them. One is electronic case filing. The bar is very interested in civil electronic case filing. That has the potential to be self-funded. It's a model that has been implemented in a few other states, and so we're going to work with them on that. Maybe pro se electronic filing if we can figure out how to pay for it. That's a popular idea, but it's not self-funding. Electronic payment of parking tickets, once again, possibly self-funding from parking revenue collections account. Electronic traffic ticket payments, possibly, once again, not self-funding, so we've got to figure out how to pay for it. An updated OJD and court web portal to better support service to the public by way of the web. Also provide some infrastructure pieces for electronic filing and other things like that. Business partner integration of the criminal history reporting. We are talking with state police. We think we may have enough in-chip funds to get started on the end-to-end integration of the criminal history reporting process. Also provides a platform for criminal information integration. And I'm sort of out ahead of that project as well, but we think that's shaping up to be funded with NCHIP dollars. And finally, electronic document management, really as the infrastructure piece for moving to a paperless court, not self-funded. We're going to try to figure out how we can fund that. And then if I could just leave you with three thoughts, although Kingsley tells me to leave you with one, so I will leave you with one. The department understands current budget realities, but hopes this can be the beginning of a conversation about our long-term need to replace OGIN. Long-term. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Question. we have a joint committee, the Joint Information. Someone help me with the
Joint Legislative Committee on Management Information Technology. Chair Gridley.
Yeah. Thank you very much,
You're
Mr.
welcome.
Ward. You're the right person for the job. And I'm assuming that you are working with that committee, and they're aware of the strategies that you are presenting to us in brief. And
Chair Gridley, members of the committee, we had the two budget notes, and along with those two budget notes in the last session was a requirement to report progress on those budget notes on a quarterly basis. And so we did that about the second quarter or so in there as we started up the strategic planning process at Robin Lamont's suggestion. We also started reporting on the progress of the strategic plan. Now you guys, of course, know a lot more about it than they do because we're essentially done now and weren't then. But
thank you very much, and you did a great job.
You,
and it was right at 10 minutes.
Yeah, I took 10. I'm sorry. As fast as I could talk.
Great job. Well, Ms. Quick, if you will move us into our final part of the agenda, which is the discussion on priorities and reduction options, I'm going to ask for Ms. Lamont's help in helping us keep focused, so that we get through this with the level of detail.
Right.
That
I think we need some dirge music on, too.
But
hum that tune for us.
Well, I will tell you that we heard wonderful music in the Senate chamber this morning as part of our opening session, and one of the songs was Amazing Grace, if that helps you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Before we get started on this, maybe you could walk through like the percentage cuts that you had for Measure 30 before we went to the governor's cuts, and then this additional 10% cut. So we've got a sequence of where all the reductions are.
That's a great suggestion.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we can get into this more as well, but just to set the stage for, I did ask Susan at the request of Representative Hannah to provide a little more detailed, but an overview of our current budget situation, but set context in 01, 05 biennium, there were five special sessions resulting in an overall reduction of $50 million. At that time, we had indigent defense. So the portion of the reduction that related directly to the trial court's appellate admin and mandate payments was $23 million. And we do have a spreadsheet that we can make available that documents at each session what the level of reduction was. As the chief, I think, mentioned in his opening remarks, in context, that was a large cut, but because every few months, as you knew painfully, you're dealing with a reduced revenue forecast that just required big chunk reductions that weren't able to be planned out over 24 months. And in the last reduction, which was approximately $13 million, we had 4 months to implement that reduction, which required the reduction in workforce and the closure of the courts.
Representative Hannah.
I might just suggest this particular document, which I think came in day one or so, has good information just about what you speak.
Summary.
On the inside of page two. It talks about the Measure 11 reduction, so it's a good piece for reference on those issues.
Thank you, Representative. Please continue.
And then in 03-05, we did start the biennium short of what you would call a current service level. There were some self-funded expectations in our original budget, but then and we planned for those. And then the Measure 30 was a $13 million reduction with the repeal of the tax increased revenue. That, from the time of the end of session, we felt we needed a plan for, so we did take a 24-month approach towards that planning.
our biggest ability to address that overall shortfall was the fact, ironically, as we're talking about opportunities out of negative consequences, at the beginning of 2003, we had over 200 positions to start refilling again from the budget cuts, and the sheer volume and the time frames to ramp back up saved us over half the cuts that we were going to have to make. And then we adjusted through, once again, reduced where we had discretionary funds, which is not a lot, but reduced capital expenditures, service and supplies, meetings, and education. And then also telling course as of January 1st that they could use like 120-day time lapses to keep capturing more vacancy savings. So that's briefly, we were able to manage to, we hope still, to the end of this biennium without layoffs and reductions in force, though we do keep having courts hold vacancies for extra months just to achieve those goals. We were pretty much, as of January, up to full workforce, except now courts are concerned about the 2005-2007 outlook, and they're starting to hold vacancies again because they, of course, don't want to go through the trauma of layoffs with their staff. We've cautioned them to be careful because it gets into a dangerous web. We're not providing the services. We don't have the staff. And yet we're holding them open. But I think people are feeling now with this few months of the biennium that they want to position themselves for whatever 2005-2007 is going to bring. So we're dealing with that.
Is that summary to your satisfaction, Representative Casa? Okay.
Then I'll let Susan just briefly overview the budget for this
05-07. Madam Chair and members of the committee, after yesterday's session, Representative Hannah had a very good question. He was looking at Legislative Fiscal Office's handout, which he was holding up just a few minutes ago, which is the summary analysis of the governor's recommended budget. And in that budget, there is the governor's budget, of course, for the his level of funding for the judicial branch. There is also a recognition of the Chief Justice's recommended budget, but what is not in that document is the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget. So Robin has just handed out to you a table that simply shows the department summary at the top and then the major budgetary programs, a listing for the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget, which has been developed in accordance with the same instructions that the executive branch and legislative branch use to calculate their essential budget level. And next to that in column two is the governor's budget level of funding for the judicial department. And keep in mind, I think it's been mentioned before, that the governor assigned that level of funding to the judicial department to balance, to be able to present a balanced budget to the legislature as he is required to do, that he was an unspecified 9% reduction, that there was no real discussion about the impact of that cut. So the difference, and we usually focus on the general fund in total, is the $24.6 million reduction in the governor's budget to the Chief Justice's operating level budget. In phase two of our budget presentations, per the court chair's instructions, we'll be talking more about the second side of this spreadsheet, which is the complete Chief Justice's recommended budget, which is the maintenance level budget plus the policy option packages. And we'll be talking more about policy option packages just to have that discussion with you in phase two.
Very good. Representative Hannah?
Yes, I appreciate good work. I mean, it's nice to be able to see this because this document does reference the Chief Justice budget.
Just as a point of personal preference, I would say that as we study this, that we might add to our spreadsheet column the 03-05 legislatively approved budget so that you have a baseline to work from. More years if necessary to get a better history, but at least to have that as a baseline, I think, is important.
And, Madam Chair, we could easily do that.
Very good.
Great.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
If you go back farther than that, you'll need to know that that we split off again off the Defense Services Commission from the Chief Justice's budget, so it takes a
Madam Chair, we can members of the committee. I would suggest that we develop their budget without the public defense in there, so that we don't have that artificial drop, and then we would treat public defense services as if they had been separate for that period of time.
Please continue.
Okay, I think we're ready to talk about the priorities and begin a discussion from that of the reduction planning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just a sort of a procedural note, the Judicial Department will be working off from the information that is in narrative form starting on page 69. However, if you are interested, you can walk through the detailed reduction list that's found in the appendix under the beige sheet.
On page 65 is basically the summary of the department's priorities, and the case type priorities were developed actually over 6 years ago. There's always been a form of them even before that with some prior budget challenges we've had, but this latest rendition has been consistent to the last three biennia. And the dedication of the department is to make sure that the highest risks to public safety and to vulnerable public cases stay at the top of what we're able to do. And so they have rated without saying that any of them are really not important to the citizens of Oregon, but just if you've got to devote your resources to making sure something gets done on time, what is it going to be aimed at? And that is certainly at the felonies and the child-related cases. I think the best way to summarize what the department's approaches or options are is we provided a replacement page 69, which goes to the phase one, page 69 that's in your book. And the reason it's replacement page is we inadvertently eliminated a case type on the right side of the page before you had a chance to weigh in, so we've added it back in.
Clarity, we have the replacement page?
Yes. It was handed out, or maybe...
Madam Chair, I handed it out. It looks exactly like that, except that it says replacement page.
At the very bottom. When I talked about the case priorities, I failed to mention the process that we came about to both identify the priorities and to identify our approaches that we've been taking in the reduction scenarios for the last several biennium. The Chief Justice, I don't know if it's under the guise of we want to be inclusive because we are, or if we're going to hang all together, but in his wisdom has had a budget reduction advisory committee. I make light of that, but it had a very serious purpose, which was to bring in our seasoned presiding judges and trial court administrators to work with us with the realities of reduced operating budgets to help
prioritize not only what was important for the department to keep doing in all channels from top to bottom, but also in what kind of approaches we would take. Where would we have statewide uniformity and where would we have local discretion? And in each of the previous biennium, I can provide you copies should it be of interest. Historically, it's been the plans that we've put together, the basic approaches for each of the last three biennium. When we got together, the committee to deal with the governor's reduction, the committee looked at the priorities, reaffirmed them, and then discussed that if they had 24 months to manage, it would be difficult, but the approach that they would recommend us starting off would be what we call thin the soup, which is do not close courts, work with whatever reduction in workforce that we have to do by kind of triaging the case types. And thin the soup doesn't mean some things don't get done at all, but they're kind of levels of you get to them when you can. What we call level one is there's restrictions that happen on certain public access hours for telephone counters and certain services to allow the staff that's left to devote itself to keeping the higher level case types on time and being processed. There also have been some reductions to the days of that trials are held, and that's still been ongoing in 05-03-05, where Multnomah does not hold jury trials on Fridays just to free up resources. Level two kind of takes the middle if we get into heavier cuts where we would have to even more dramatically reduce the public service hours and rearrange our case types. And then level three, which would happen certainly somewhere in the 10% and beyond range, would require us to revisiting the court closure issues. As we mentioned, you know, we're statewide. There's a minimum to have a court in any county in the state. I think our minimum is probably the minimum that's acceptable for the citizens. We do try and leverage services statewide through pro tems, through judges helping out in other places, through staff helping out with other places, through centrally trying to provide services to everyone to balance them out. So we felt that our options are really twofold, which is one, what we call thin the soup, which it's a reduction in force, reduction in service hours, reduced services, and the risks you run are the increased risks of recidivism and all the things that go with the, what we call the cracked courthouse display. We also put those in terms of 4 D's in case someone thought if we had 4 R's that would be unbalanced, and that is the justice delayed, the programs degraded, the programs dismantled, the public services and workforce depleted.
Ms. Could you turn the microphone a little bit more towards
you? It's ringing.
We're getting just a little bit of feedback. Thank you.
So for us, because we're constitutional and statutory, the choices are basically with reduction in force, because that's the majority of our budget. We're over 90% general funded. We're over 90% personnel. That our major way of addressing less revenue is through reduction in workforce after we've gone through everything else that we can reduce that advantage. When you talked earlier, Senator Devlin, I believe, about vacancies and some other budget presentations I was hearing, as we mentioned in 01-03, we got up to 27% of our workforce either through layoff or holding vacancies or otherwise reduction in hours.
our best way of this past biennium of achieving our goals were through the same sorts of techniques, holding open positions, filling differently, and that even if it holds whole the system, it does reduce the services available. It does create the inner delays. So if faced again with reductions, we would look to what, you know, once again, where we could come up with further economies. So, as I think you heard Judge Koch mention, there weren't easy choices last time, but even those choices that we made last time with various types of staff aren't there this time. So we're at a different level if we're with where we would have to start our reductions as far as service providers within our department. So we can, you know, manage smaller cuts through kind of deliberate holding of vacancies at certain levels for certain amounts of time, given the trade-offs. But beyond that, then we do get into what we call the much more dire effects. And the programs and the initiatives and the performance measures that yesterday are where we want to be and what we want to be doing are the ones that are most jeopardized, while the courts, because a lot of those specialized approaches to case types are also our priority case types, they would strive to keep those programs in place, but it would not be without a cost to the other parts of the system. So,
Representative Hannah.
Forgive me for jumping ahead, but as we look at these priority levels, I want to try to be able to look at your page 69 that has that, and I want to be able to reference that to the summary pages, the detail. So if I were looking at these priority levels that you've listed on case type priorities, would I then be looking at the summary based off the governor's recommended budget reduction list? Is that the priority list that I'd be looking at?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, could I ask the department to explain the four spreadsheets that you have so that it will help you to understand what it is they've given you and how to use it?
Well, can I follow up, please? That's what I'm getting at, is you have four spreadsheets that we need to link to these priorities. And as I look at these priorities, just as an example, you know, the priority ranking to me would be, you know, one might be the one you want to lose the least, and 10 might be the one you wanted to lose the most. If you're going 1 to 10, I mean, but you have multiple items ranked as 1 through whatever. Well, I don't know if you go. Yeah, you do go to 10. So I guess my question is, one, which spreadsheet relates to the priority, and two, I'm confused as to what number 1 or 10 means, because, like, here's a number 10 item that's, you know, $25.7 million of your budget, and yet it's ranked 10. To me, that would indicate it's one you don't mind losing, and I'm thinking, not that you don't mind losing, that you less mind losing. So help me.
Chair Gordley, Representative Hannah, the spreadsheets reflect the priorities that are on here. There is one difference, and we'll explain when we go through, in how the levels will match up to the case types. I mentioned that the reduction to the governor's level, the department, if nothing changed, would take a thin-the-soup approach to that. So in that sense, there's a spreadsheet that says, it's the second one, because the first one tells you what the number is and how it translates, and then the second one tells you how does it apply, would be the thin-the-soup plan. And so it takes different percentages of those different case types. The second two, which are adding on another 10%, are under the take something off-the-plate plan, which is repeals levels of statutory case types and responsibilities to correspond with estimated resource levels associated with processing that. And I think, as you've heard some other speakers say, we can compartmentalize based on our workload studies approximately how many staff are devoted to certain functions, how many judges are devoted to certain functions, but those are associated with statewide. So you might have like 1/10 of a person here who does small claims, 1/4 of a person here who does small claims. So it's
Ms. Clift,
it is associated with actual cost, but it's everybody's really a unit.
Let me stop you right there before a already complicated situation becomes even more complex. I'm going to ask Ms. Lamont to assist you, assist us in understanding the documents that we have. And thank you, Representative Hannah, for jumping ahead.
First, let me see if I get this right. The first spreadsheet that you have that's called Program Division Priorities of the Chief Justice's Maintenance Level Budget, General Fund Only, is a description of the department's priorities at the Chief Justice's maintenance level. So that's the first description. The second spreadsheet essentially describes how the Judicial Department would implement the governor's budget, the 9% reduction to the Chief Justice's maintenance level. The third spreadsheet is a description of the programs and priorities at the governor's recommended budget level. And the fourth spreadsheet is a detail of the 10% reduction to the governor's budget, which is then a 19% cumulative reduction to the total agency budget. Does that help clarify that piece?
Can I follow up?
Please.
I think I'm clear on that, and I appreciate that. What I still am missing and seeking, mm-hmm. and let's go back to the first one that you described being the program, the vision, priorities of the Chief Justice Maintenance Level Budget, General Fund. Just take the first line. The priority is zero. The rank is zero.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me explain that, because that is something that LFO approved for several agencies, where there is an administrative service that cuts across a number of program areas. It's not possible to prioritize those services or to identify reductions to those services until you know where you're taking reductions in other program areas. So, for example, business services might actually end up having a reduction at some point if, in fact, you're reducing a lot of the other services, but it is not prioritized or ranked at this point as part of the overall ranking within the program areas. Some agencies lump them together. Other agencies have segregated them out. In this case, the department has segregated these services out and tied the dollars to them, but have not ranked them.
Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me just a moment. Let's take another example then. The first item, Circuit Court, rank 1, priority 1, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. The next 8 items are rank 1.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a difficult exercise for this branch of government to do, because they have legal requirements in terms of what they are required to do. So rather than try to identify which of their most important functions is more important than any other, they have assigned the same number within the overall priority ranking. And
Madam Chair, if I may, to...
Before you go further, I want to make sure Representative Hannah, does that get at the question, or do you still have a question?
I think that addresses the question, but I guess a comment is, and I know that it's very difficult, and if it's really difficult for you all who do this, how much more difficult might it be for those of us who don't do it and to prioritize it? You know, do you want an Air Force guy and a Coke bottler to make the list, or what do you want, the attorneys and judges and so on? I mean, that's the question, I guess. If it's hard for you, it's equally hard or harder for us. And with you know, to just throw a one on the first eight items, you know, we're going to have to be responsible to our chairman to say, here's what we think it's got to be. Is that correct? At some point.
That is correct, but I want to also say to you and just reaffirm that every question you're asking is exactly what this committee is supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be questioning assumptions and unpacking the information that's being presented to us. So we very much appreciate your diligence, Representative Hannah.
Senator Gordley, Representative Hannah, just, well, hopefully you're not dealing with the ones, but we're really in trouble. But just as a point of clarification, as Ms. Lamont said on administration, we do reduce to what level of service is still left. So there would be reductions. Should there be an overall reduction, it's just not prioritized because it does go with the other services. And then the two first ones, mandamus and habeas, those are constitutional writs. So they're out there for the Supreme Court no matter what you do on, you know, as a case type, as you will. And then the appellate courts have a one, not because there wouldn't be a reduction potential in their budgets, but one, they're constitutional, well, the Supreme Court is, so that's the only court that survives all this. But their case types are all driven by what's happening with the trial courts and what's coming up to 50% of the Supreme Court load. The rest comes from initiatives and ballot titles and other customers. So it's not that they wouldn't have potentially a reduction, because they have taken reductions in the last three biennium and talked to the resource depletions that have gone on there, but it's just those are our appellate courts are all ones, and they are adjust like to whatever happens to the rest. As we mentioned yesterday, trial courts are 70% of our budget. The mandated payments is an additional 4%. So
a part of what you are wanting us to understand is that there are constitutional and statutory mandates driving your prioritization. You've also provided us with a document in our notebooks that lays out the various constitutional and statutory and other mandates that, again, are driving your priorities.
If I may, Madam Chairman of the Committee, Representative Hannah, that you actually give my speech. This is all theoretical. You're the people, your predecessor is the one who gave us all these assignments, and you've kind of rated them. We can't quit anything. We did it for 4 months by not appointing lawyers in the defense side. I got sued in federal court, both in Portland and in Eugene, went all the way to the Ninth Circuit, and it was resolved because you can't do that. There's a constitutional duty to provide lawyers and a statutory duty. So you really are in the driver's seat. If there's some things on here you don't want us to do, repeal the statute. Now, you'll find most of them are criminal law, and I sense a lack of public support for decriminalizing what it is we do. So we both share this. We're not doing it because we're volunteers. We're doing it because the Constitution says do it, like habeas corpus. It'd be nice to get rid of that. But that's the grand writ. That's the last thing we ought to get rid of. So we're not going to get rid of that. And then we go on down the sheet. And my only point is, and actually the chair made it better than I did, and that is that the two points I have is that this is not a voluntary system and going out and doing good. We're doing what the Constitution and you have told us to do by statute. And if we don't have the money to do it, we suggested 2 years ago repeal those statutes, and that's what the old VATs we have or the silos, in order to keep us at a full workforce to be able to do it well and repeal the statutes all below or above the line and then either match our money with what our assignment is or reduce our plate load, reduce our assignment to match the money you have available. Very simple. Mm-hmm. You know, conceptual. It won't work, but it's very simple. So that's the only point I would want to make. I don't envy you in your position, and that's why our alternative probably will be just to thin the suit. Because until you tell us stop doing small claims, we have to do small claims, and we will do small claims. But they'll get in line, and they'll get in line according to the priorities we've set here. But the priorities we've set in the silos up here are what we think trial court administrators, and as a matter of fact, this was quite an effort. There are 189 members of the judiciary, and we got, with some grumbling, support for that list of priorities from 189. And we used to talk about herding cats. They're all independently elected. 17 of them are elected statewide, and yet they came together to help us take those cuts we did before. Could we do it again? I hope not. I mean, I hope can, but I don't know if can. So thank you for letting me butt in. But
thank you very much, Chief. You just really helped make the point. And the cats are named me and Al. Senator Dublin and Representative Hansen.
This may be a question, Madam Chair, for the Chief Justice. So. Well, one is a question for the Chief Justice, and one is a very technical question, which he may want to give to someone else, actually. Did the Ninth Circuit, Mr. Chief Justice, did the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals actually render a decision?
They did. From Lane County, it was District Attorney Harper Road and Ross Shepard, the public defender, and in Multnomah County, it was District Attorney Shrunk and Jim, the public defender Jim Henning, sued me in federal district court, the trial court. Judge Hogan ruled in what I did, and that is suspending the appointment of lawyers for 4 months. They contended it was unconstitutional because both federally and state you have a right to have an attorney. What we did is postpone it. Could we get away with it for 24 months? No way. In fact, the day that we celebrated the 40th year, I think it was, of Gideon versus Wainwright, with OC, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, was the same day we cut a hunk out of our indigent defense budget 2 years ago. I should have gotten the Hypocrite of the Year award that time for violating a constitutional obligation. I only postponed it. And Judge Hogan said, no, at least temporarily, it's okay. We were also sued, or you were sued, and your leaders were sued in mandamus in the Supreme Court. I recused myself, and the Supreme Court said they're imperiling the function of the third branch, but not so severely yet that the Supreme Court intervened. The federal case then went down to the Ninth Circuit, and they ultimately, then July 1 passed, we left the core dark months where the lights were out, started a new biennium, we started appointing attorneys and so on. So then the state that represented, Attorney General's office represented as well, and pointed out that it was over, and to get any kind of an injunction to tell me to do what I was already doing would not be worth it. So they dismissed the proceeding, and federally they have a thing that's moot but avoiding review but likely to be repeated, but the three court panel said effectively said they'll take it up again if we go back that way again, so it was dismissed.
Follow up. Mr. Chief Justice, for a lay person I think it's pretty easy to understand the issue of providing counsel and the requirement to provide counsel. I've always heard a reference to this, but never knew whether it was embodied really in constitutional law, never even bothered to check far enough into another area, and that isn't the providing counsel, but in terms of providing a timely or speedy trial.
Is that issue ever been up for litigation in terms of if you deferred prosecution, you would actually be in a sense?
I'm also an expert on that, sadly.
I know one case that
is... J.B. Harvard's out of your area up yeah. there where we... it was not a financial problem, but the case was delayed about 6 years, and the person was held in jail without any opportunity for bail, and before he even went to trial, it was not post-trial, and that is out there. And we get a few cases a year where the argument is made it's taken too long to decide the case, and we take each one as it comes. But there is a constitutional provision of. Process. Timeline process.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. And now, Madam Chair, for the very technical questions.
I think I can leave.
In the presentation of this sheet that shows the different budgets and where you have the Chief Justice's essential budget level budget, and you identify a shortfall of $24.6 million from that level for your essential budget. This doesn't include, of course, any of your policy option packages.
Right.
Is the assumption within that number that you are receiving your proportionate share of the $120 million that's been set aside in the e-board, or is the assumption that you are not? It might only equal out to a couple million dollars, given your size, out of that 120, but the 120 that's been set aside for... dealing with collective bargaining agreements, is that included within that number or not included within that number?
I can answer the question. the issue of the $120 million is separate from the 24.6.
Okay.
This is the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget based on costs that are known to date. The $120 is set aside for future negotiations.
Okay. So any future negotiations might bring that number higher.
And that's that number would experience. Have
They, Madam Chair members, they would get their proportionate share of that 120, whether or not that 120 was sufficient to cover all of the costs associated
right.
is a different discussion.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hannah and then Senator Winters.
Thank you. But I will point out I'm going to change the subject just a little bit, so if you have something still on this...
I just for clarification's sake, wanted to make certain that Representative Hannah knew what we were talking about when we talked about the $120 million set aside. And if he knows, then we're fine.
Well, I know a little, not as much as those of you who have all the experience, but I've read.
Okay.
So that's how much I know.
But this is a good point, because if we need to back up and fill that piece in, not only for Representative Hannah, but for the record that we're creating, yeah. then let's take time to do that with Ms. Lamont's help.
I'm pressing again on these priorities. I think we now have a good answer to item to what the ones are. And I want to sort of paraphrase and correct me if I'm wrong. The case-type priorities that are constitutional and statutory, those are critical, and those would be item one. Is that close?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hannah, actually the case types that are statutory go through case type 16. So would require...
But their rank is one. If we came to this page.
No, you would go through the appellate courts and then you would hit one, which is person-to-person felonies for both case types and for mandated payments. And then two would be juvenile permanency matters. And then it should correspond with either a program or a case type, and the numbers should be the same all the way down.
Okay. Follow-up, please. Is there any priority and because I can't look at this and know, what priority, or if any, would be given to case types that are revenue-generating to you? Of the $198.2 million, which of these case types is revenue-producing, and what priority level is given to that?
If I may, and I clearly can be second-guessed, Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, at my direction, they're not rated to it. If we could do that, because, for instance, Multnomah County, if it didn't have to pay for engine defense, which it doesn't have to, and because of their fact they're also a municipal court and get the meter money, they actually make a little money. We chose not to go through, or at least I believe we chose, at my direction, not to go through and save the revenue ones and get rid of the ones that cost us money. I'd like to do that. The first one to go would be the death penalty and aggravated murder. Those are extraordinarily expensive, and we never return a profit on those cases. But it's antithetical to what we think the public wants us to do. So we started that to say, well, okay, if we had a choice between those we save money, we're more like education than we are like the bottling business, in the sense that we're not designed to turn a profit. That doesn't mean we can't be held accountable for the money we expend and the fact that we ought to be efficient and careful with the dollars because of the taxpayers' dollars. But our cost centers are cost centers and not necessarily profit centers. But you have that. We do make a profit in some things, and you have that here. We're trying to maintain that and not lose those, but we will lose those when we lose our FTEs and things. I don't know whether I've given you the right answer, but several said, let's do it that way. That will resonate in the legislature. Put at the top priority those things that actually are cost neutral or make us some money. And we took a look at it, and the stuff that we're required to do for felony court, for instance, big time loser in terms of your.
I'm going to ask analyst Lamont if she'd like to comment here. I know you would.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as a matter of fact, that's a very good question. The department has identified its priorities as public safety, in essence. The most important parts of this are public safety and child related. The parts of their caseload that actually generate money for the general fund are their civil matters. And those are a lower priority in terms of their mission.
Okay. Thank you. Follow up. I want to make sure that I'm pleased that you're using good reasoning for making the decision. I'm not being judgmental as to whether you were or were not seeking revenue, but I do want to understand the priorities. And so I'm trying to vet these things out. When it's $200 million, it's worth asking the question.
Madam Chair, we ask ourselves, because it is a good question, and that is there any virtue of going through? Of course, there's virtue, and you have the information on where we make money to the extent that we make money. Any virtue in going through and trying to save those as opposed to the others, and not as usual, has nailed it.
I agree.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the same general discussion, you mentioned that capital punishment and aggravated murder are both loss leaders. I don't think
we're getting down there.
Okay. Yeah, we're not getting cheap in justice or anything like that. I guess that's, I would love to see of your costs for capital punishment, how that is a program area. And my sense is that in terms, if we're dedicating our dollars towards the greatest amount of public safety we can produce, I would think that that's probably an area that produces the least benefit for the dollar. But I'd like to see where the dollars flow, because that may be helpful in terms of talking to the public and at what's the cost of this versus the increment of public safety that we're getting for the expense. And it goes through, obviously, the judiciary is just one very small piece of the whole puzzle.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, we do have estimated costs for each of these case categories and also the estimated revenue, so we can provide that.
Okay.
Senator Gordley, Representative Hansen, and we have in other fiscal impacts looked at the cost of the courts of doing a death penalty trial, versus true life. The only thing is, if you remove the death penalty, then if true life becomes the most serious consequence, it's possible that those costs would then increase to conduct that type of proceeding. So with that caveat, we do have information about how much now in general between the different outcomes and case types.
There would be, Madam Chair, there would be a corrections component, obviously. At least theoretically, there would be a corrections component for true life as opposed to death.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
Senator Winters.
When we had when you went through the other budget reductions, one of the decisions made was that, you know, courts didn't open on Fridays. And with where we are today and looking at both the reductions in the governor's packet, because you're starting 24, I think it's about 24, and then the addition of the 10, of the other 10%, has you had the discussion of whether you'd have to go back to that particular decision again to where you can't open the courts?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, the Budget Reduction Advisory Committee and a lot of us have had those discussions. The present position we are is addressing the $24.4 million that we lost in the governor's proposal, and we have not yet addressed the 10%, I mean, they have addressed, but the cure for the 10%, we have discussed it. The closure is merely a function of not having enough employees to keep the door open. And we did it last time with the furlough and laying off 100 or...
Well, we had 27% of our workforce.
20% of our workforce dropped out of sight. So rather than... Because we'd had the experience in Marion County when our treasurer invested in Ginnie Mae's, and President Carter thought 21% was a good interest rate for the country, and the result was that Marion County all but went bankrupt. So we voluntarily, when I was in the trial court system, rather than fire anybody, they all worked four-fifths for four-fifths pay, and that was kind of our model for what we did in the tail end of 03. Rather than fire everybody, then hopefully we can get, not everybody, a whole host, everybody would take a reduction. But that was only for a relatively short period of time, and I don't think we can sustain it, could sustain it over a 24-month period. So to answer your question, right now our plan is to thin the soup. That is to say, unless you take things away from us, take them off our plate, we will do everything that the Constitution and you have required of us to do. The only room we have is to set the priority of how, not do it numerically, first in, first out, but to do it by our importance, and we would do it according to the list here.
We give
priority to public safety and child and family. And then, and unfortunately, as a session, one of the representatives from who is well-versed in business said, I see businesses right at the bottom. And the answer is, yeah, it is. And you could alter that, but the Greg McPherson, in case there's any question about it, but he picked right out of it that doesn't take much to look at it and say, well, all the civil business transactions are the last priority. And the answer is indeed. That's unfortunate.
So, Chief, not to cut you off, but just being mindful of the time and just wanting to get right to the cut right to the chase, the $24 million hole, which is what we're talking about, your way of implementing that level of cut is captured in this list.
Sure.
On the right-hand side, top of the page. So we're talking about a reduction in workforce, eliminating the post-conviction relief, eliminating small claims, eliminating property-only domestic relations, eliminating probate, eliminating the 20% of associated costs required on the civil side, and on down the line. This is the level of cut that we're talking about.
Madam Chair, if I may, this is the same list we had for the budget reduction advisory at the tail end of 03, and we did eliminate most of those. The word elimination is overkill, because we're not going to have a constitutional conversation with you or others by saying we don't care what you told us to do. It's Tuesday and we're not going to do them. We won't say that. We will put them in priorities. Now, the net effect very well may be that they're at the end of the line, and we never get to the end of the line based on our workforce. Mm-hmm. So, in a practical sense, we will not tell you that we will not do, we will stop doing what you told us to do. But we will do the very best we can do it along these priorities, unless you want to reorder the priorities, because mm-hmm. you're our bosses in this sense. So.
Representative Hansen and then Senator Devlin.
Well, to get a real clear picture of what we're talking about, like in the circuit court felonies, non-person, we'd be cutting $3.5 million out of $39 million, roughly 10%. It's a level 7 priority.
Non-person felonies.
So we would still be doing significant activity with non-person felonies, but you'd prioritize and probably 10 or 15% of them would not be prosecuted, or would be prosecuted be on a waiting. Although if they aren't prosecuted timely or scheduled timely, they'd go away. But it'd be interesting if we could get some type of a guesstimate in terms of what are the types of non-person felonies that would likely not to get the attention of the court with that kind of a scenario. Same thing with circuit court violations, and I don't know how you would do it on civil court, if that would be first in, first out, or would you do the somehow prioritize it different than time.
Committee members, are you time check? Are you willing to spend an additional 5 minutes plus past our usual adjourn time?
I have to be up in my office at 3, actually.
Those committee members who can, remain 5 minutes. Thank you. Ms. Klosterman, did you wish to speak to this?
I, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, you're looking for a prioritization within these major case categories, something a little more specific. If I could clarify one more thing, Madam Chair. The first 9%, we really have two scenarios. The Budget Reduction Advisory Committee developed a plan that would thin the soup, assuming that we would be required to continue the current statutory responsibilities. But as an alternative, would suggest a discussion with the legislature to repeal these listed statutory requirements. And then the second level, the additional 10%, the scenarios in the spreadsheet are developed assuming that at that level there would need to be a serious discussion about removal of statutory requirements, because thinning the soup is really not a viable alternative.
I may be able to see the bottom of the bowl then.
I'm just going to say, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that clarified, you were reading right off our list, and that's the explanation. Mm-hmm. That if we send our first order is thin the soup, but then, as I mentioned earlier, that if you repeal some of the requirements for us to have our activity, then that's another saving. I don't think that's realistic, but that is an option.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is available to this group. As to the other 10%, if I may, Madam Chair, we may get down to closing the court. It's all workforce is what the question is, and we found in Marion County you can't run a window with one employee counter. It just won't work, and so it's better if you only have 4 employees to have them there for 4 days or 3 days and not have one a day and trying to run a business.
Madam Chair, Justice Carlson, as you know, I was there in 81.
I know that, ma'am.
And this is reminding me, although we don't have double-digit inflation, but it was very painful.
Well, if I may, Madam Chair, what we did is when things were filed, rather than being filed, they were put filed in the court, they were put in boxes. And Judge Paul Lipscomb came 6 years after that period, and they were still in boxes. And these are court records where liens and all kinds of things were involved. It was a meltdown, and that's not what we're talking about here, but it was not good, and we chose not to put everything in boxes.
Ms. Lamont, do you have any closing comments or guidance that you'd like to share?
Only, Madam Chair, only to say that I don't envy this committee or myself and the rest of the other analysts the chore that we have in front of us, because you also cannot look at what the Judicial Department has in front of it in a vacuum. That is, the actions that get taken with this budget will also affect what happens with other budgets, with the number of persons that are incarcerated, with what the requirements are for public defense services. So there's going to be a need to look at this whole issue systemically, and it's going to be very difficult. I personally haven't figured out how to even help, let alone make any recommendations on how to get there.
Representative Hansen.
Quick comment. When I was the county commissioner, I sat in for a couple of years on public safety meetings that would occur once a month to kind of coordinate between the sheriff and district attorney and the county and the judiciary. Judge Launder would schedule those. And the complexity in Multnomah County with the number of judges, the number of jurors, getting the defendant, the jury, the judge, getting it all together and have it all come together in one courtroom is real complicated. And any time you impact any one part of that, it complicates the life of every other agency, especially if there's any kind of a slowdown, because it dramatically affects the jail, who's released from the jail, how long people stay in the jail before they're released, and with the overcrowding situation that we already have in the funding, it becomes it's real easy for this whole system to just become dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And that's a very real threat that we're facing.
Representative Hansen, I'd like to draw on your knowledge and wisdom and that of Representative Wisnant, and I'll speak to him later, joining me in working with Ms. Lamont to take an even deeper look together with the department at what some of our options might be, if you would be willing to do that. And I want to thank the Chief and Ms. Klosterman and Ms. Click for your presentations this afternoon and for all of your hard work and all of those behind you and within the sound of our voices who have helped prepare the documents that we are learning from. I also want to say to Ms. Click, you owe Ms. Piggy or P.S. Piggy $2 for ADA. I owe $1 for ADA. That was yesterday. And are there any other comments for the good of the order?
Madam Chair, I was extra tardy today, and I hope you explain my extra tardiness.
I will do that, and thank you for reminding me. Senator Winters, along with Senator Westland, Senators Bates and Carter, all were honored today by the Oregon Health Forum for their huge efforts around
health care reform and maintaining some decent level of health care services in Oregon. And so we congratulate you on the honor, and we honor you for all that we know you do outside of this committee.
Thank you. Well, I didn't want them to think that I was neglecting them today.
Madam Chair, if I may, I want to thank the committee. You've been very engaged and helpful, and we thank you for the opportunity and your attendance. And let me leave you with this, and that's my fortune cookie message, and that is sell your ideas. They have exceptional merit, and I ask you to keep that in mind.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief. Thank you. Thank you, committee. We're adjourned.